And again, you're in education, like I studied literature. The teacher who puts the hat on backwards, turns the chair around and says, yo, 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 yeah, my dogs, let's rap about TikTok.
Right.
And your kids are like, I hate you.
Yeah,
like,
it's
culturally appropriating and trying way too hard.
That's right.
Too hard.
It's nothing. It's the Steve Buscemi, you know, gif. What's up, my fellow kids?
Hi, everybody. Welcome back to our podcast, Everything That Rises, about all the great short stories of the one and only Miss Flannery O'Connor. My name is John Meehan. I am an English teacher, an author, a speaker, presenter, and a lover of books and stories and writing. And I figured, why not get people who are smarter than me to hang out and talk about all of these things? And so I've invited a good friend from college. Do you want to say hi and introduce yourself?
Sure. My name is Christopher Michalski, and I work in the Office of Research and Economic Development at Louisiana State University. And I have my doctorate in English, actually also from LSU. And I like all of the things that John said. I want to take that as my sign in. Lover of literary educator.
That's fantastic. And you're downplaying it. You do have a PhD in like this stuff, so you're actually way more qualified than I am to talk about.
Thanks.
It.
I'll take it. I appreciate it.
And you live in the South, which is way more than me. Like I'm here from New Jersey, recording in Washington D.C., and that is not at all the world of Flannery O'Connor and her stories. Have you found, because your accent is definitely not Southern by origin.
That's right, it's not. My family's, my parentage, I guess, is all from the Mid-Atlantic region, like Pennsylvania, and actually New Jersey. But I grew up in Florida, and I've been in Baton Rouge now for over 10 years. And yeah, I know the South. I've had the South in my blood, as it were, I guess, since like third grade or so. So I don't know. I've always been resistant to accents, but I never, ever, ever developed one. I think it's partially my inclination toward language. You know, I was always extremely conscientious of what I was saying, but you know, it's funny you should say that though, because the story does lend itself really well to talking about geographic differences and in terms of race too.
I think you're right on the money, and I'm so excited about that because each week we bring on a different guest. So if you are new to the podcast, feel free to subscribe, like, leave a comment, find on your favorite podcasting app. But what we find is each week I invite somebody to hang up with us or hang out with us and just talk about a story. And what I find is the people who I bring in always get to pick the story they want to talk about. And it's always the perfect story for the guest that we have. And I think that's super cool because this one does deal with both being of a place and not of a place, both being college educated and being provincial, being local. And the story we're talking about this week is actually the title of the story of our podcast, Everything That Rises Must Converge, the short story by Flannery O'Connor, which gives its name to this podcast. Chris, because you are our guest of honor, do you want to do the honors and do like a Netflix style episode summary of what this story is about with some light spoilers before we get into the
Sure. Detail? So Everything That Rises Must Converge, as you said, is the title story of Flannery O'Connor's last collection of stories. Actually, I think it was published posthumously. And so in the story, there's this college-age man, Julian, and his mother. And she's supposed to be losing weight. And so she has to get on the bus, I think, every week or so. I can't remember how often it is. And Julian, who he's just educated enough to really, really despise his mother, but he also kind of recognizes the amount his mother's done for him over the course of his life. So he kind of self-sacrificially accompanies her. But at the same time, he's extremely embarrassed by her and looks for every opportunity he can to kind of give her comeuppance that he doesn't feel he can dole out to her himself.
Sure. And kind of put her in her place.
Yeah, exactly. Put her in her place. Yeah. And so the course of the story takes place as they get on this bus, and essentially Julian works increasing diligence to embarrass his mother on the bus in terms of racial interactions. So he's just trying desperately to make her feel as uncomfortable as possible with her white supremacy. until it finally really, really works with actually very little to do with him. But she ends up getting quite stunned at the end, and it seems to break her.
That's a good point. We'll talk about where and how that breaking comes. Yeah. So what we do is we take this podcast, and this week we'll do about 45 minutes on the first half of the podcast. If you don't have a copy of the story, it is available online in legal avenues and otherwise. and in a time of coronavirus or shutdown, reading is good. So feel free to give a check to the story for real. We're going to do a deep dive for the first 45 minutes or so about like the first half of the story, about the getting onto the bus, who these characters are and the world that they live in. And then the next week, we'll dial back in and we'll talk about life on the bus and this big build to this dramatic twist at the end, which seems to be a very trademark move of Flannery O'Connor. She's like M. Night Shyamalan, but like good at
that's right. That's right.
So let's talk about here, Everything That Rises Must Converge. First of all, the name of this story. I've probably read this story conservatively, let's say a dozen times-ish. Mm-hmm. There's a audiobook version. If you want to find a good audiobook, that's narrated by Bronson Pinchot. And if you ever seen him, like on like Perfect Strangers back in the '80s, that's amazing. So he's the narrator of it on the audiobook. But I was struck this time when not dialing it up because I just went back in before the podcast and just to check my notes and highlighted the title of the story is "Everything That Rises Must Converge," and talk about like Bruce Willis being dead in The Sixth Sense. The first line of the story is her doctor had told Julian's mother that she must lose 20 pounds on account of her blood pressure. I'm thinking things that rise and blood pressure.
I had not thought of that. Yeah.
Totally missed that. And then when I watched it through this time, they mentioned the word rising and blood pressure in close conjunction with one another, like half a dozen times in this story.
Oh, all right.
That's what we would call foreshadowing. Anything else that struck you in this, just the outset of this story from the, like, just the earliest, you know, like the earliest lines or the earliest paragraphs as they're just sort of funneling in from the world outside to like zooming into the world.
Sure. Well, you know, definitely the thing that really sticks out the most, for me is Saint Sebastian. And actually I was talking to my mother-in-law about this story and I mentioned, you know, I said, we were going to be talking about this story and she goes, Saint Sebastian. And so that's something that just sticks out so well to me because it's an extremely, it's a pitch perfect description of Julian. This moment where he's waiting for her to get ready and she's being very vain about herself and just talking and just going on and on about this hat, according to him, you know. And so Flannery O'Connor describes him as waiting like Saint Sebastian for the arrows to begin piercing him. And this kind of overinflated sense of self-sacrifice is a great. Right. And so that always stuck out to me as such a. It's a very O'Connor moment, just this kind of like, it's such a mundane and pedestrian thing that they're doing. But for him, and here's the crazy part, I don't know how she does this, but that she manages to both give you a sense of the overinflated sense of this guy, but at the same time, this whole outing does end up taking on extreme significance for them. So it's both funny, but then by the end, you're like, this is an extremely sad sad and important and tragic event in their lives.
I'm reminded of that line from A Good Man Is Hard to Find, which seems to be like, if you understand one line from all of Flannery O'Connor, it's the one that the Misfit says at the end of that story, where it's like, she would have been a good woman if there was someone there to shoot her every minute of her life.
Yeah.
Like, we're encountering these radical moments that will change your fate and or like reveal your fate. And in the beginning, you kind of throw off this throwaway line about Saint Sebastian because IRL, Saint Sebastian is a martyr in the Christian church who was apparently like tied to a tree and they shot him with a bunch of arrows, but that didn't kill him. So then he, he's arrow proof and he comes back and warns them or tries to warn, I guess, Emperor Diocletian about like, hey, you should convert, get your life right. And they're like, just kidding, we'll beat you to death with clubs. But like there's something about this story that is like a mock sacrifice or a mock of a martyr that ends up being, just kidding.
That really is, you're right.
I'm also reminded of, I do a little bit of light research for these podcasts. The Emperor Julian, whose name pops up to me like in Roman history, who famously rejected Christian.
Right.
So that the boy's name is Julian is not.
Exactly. No, that's exactly right. Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. Yeah.
So here we go. So they're on their way to the class at the Y, she says it was for working girls over 50 who weighed 165 to 200 pounds. She was on the skinnier side, so she says, but you couldn't tell. I love that idea that everybody's sort of hedging their bets and overstating their own
self. Right.
That's here. But then she says that the classes are called a reducing class, which is like a, I guess, a dated term we would call for like a weight loss class or like a spin class, something like that. But that idea of reducing class will come up again later. And she doesn't like riding the bus by herself because buses had been integrated. Right. Thoughts on that, Chris Michalski?
Okay, well, you know, pardon me. So that's it's actually fitting. So I'm, you know, I said I'm at LSU, which is in Baton Rouge, and so this is actually really, really fitting because not a lot of people know that the famous Montgomery bus boycott was patterned off of the Baton Rouge bus boycott. So
facts,
yeah, big facts. So, but I'm always really proud of that aspect of Baton Rouge, that it was the churches in Baton Rouge, the black churches in Baton Rouge, that had kind of developed that. And oh gosh, I'm really terrible. I'm blanking on the man who organized it, but it was a pastor in Baton Rouge, and it happened a couple of years before they ended up doing it in Montgomery. But that was one of the reasons why it was so effective in Montgomery, is that they had it had been kind of workshopped, I guess, as it were, here in Baton Rouge. So yeah, so the integration that's happening in like 53, 54, or at least the, the initial boycotts that led to it getting integrated happened in the early 50s. And so it started getting integrated over the course of, over the mid to late 50s.
This is cool. And I want to talk about, so I'm doing real life fact checking, because that's what I can do. It's like the West Wing, when they're in that episode where they're watching like the State of the Union and they're real time tracking like how the polls are going. The Reverend's name is T.J.
Thank
Jameson.
Thank you. Yes. Jameson. Yes. I'm so sorry. I couldn't remember his name.
Yeah. I'll pretend like I knew that.
That's right.
But there it is. But I will also say that what's interesting here is talk about the integration and desegregation of the buses. You and I both went to a Catholic university, mm-hmm. in fact, the Catholic University of America in Washington, D.C. And what's interesting is that many, not all, but many diocesan Catholic high schools were built in the 1950s and 1960s, mm-hmm. not unrelated to the fact that the public schools at the time were desegregated.
That's right.
And the rise of Catholic education in these like parochial schools was, in theory, to preserve Catholic identity and to preserve Catholic tradition in the face of what was seen as like an increasing secularization of the schools at mm-hmm. the time. But low-key, we kind of have to talk about the elephant in the room, which is not a lot of black folk are practicing Roman Catholics. A lot of Roman Catholics don't feel comfortable seeing their tradition pushed aside or brushed aside or, you know, forgotten.
Right.
And so what winds up happening is there is some systemic racism kind of at the heart of a lot of things that are, in even though they're aspirationally good, mm-hmm. That are like, you know, social changes or upheavals of the 1950s and 60s. And you can't deny that conversation about church and state are kind of all swirling in the same.
That's so spot on. And, you know, again, unfortunately, I find Baton Rouge at the center. I don't mean to keep bringing this up, except that it's so relevant. But another thing. So Baton Rouge itself has been in the news in the past couple of years because our parish. So we have counties. Our counties down here are parishes. They're called parishes. So
exactly.
Exactly. Right. So our parish, East Baton Rouge Parish, just recently voted. This is actually taken several years to happen, and through some finagling. But a group of organizers in the wealthier eastern part of the city have been working diligently for a decade or so to try to separate the richer, frankly, whiter section of the city, to break it off from Baton Rouge to become its own, city, really, so that it can become its own school district. And in fact, they had no interest in making their own city. They just had their interest in making their own school district. And I think some opponent had kind of flippantly said, well, if you want, you know, like the only way you can have your own school district if it's your own town. And so they said, okay. So they were successful this past year in breaking off. And so, the name of the town is St. George. So, they've been in, I mean, it's been written up in the Atlantic about, I think there's an Atlantic article called The New Secession that has to do with cities like Baton Rouge that are kind of continuing to, you know, create this. And Baton Rouge is filled with Catholic schools that all developed for exactly that reason. And then it's continuing into the 21st century, where they're breaking off school districts to kind of pool their money over in that area so that they don't fund the North Baton Rouge schools that are failing.
Yeah. And it's interesting too, because Flannery O'Connor is a lens through which we can study the human condition, and that's awesome. And it does lend immediate like mindfulness or credence to the idea of like the COVID shutdowns and how like the most urban areas are often the most populated areas, but they're also the most diverse areas, mm-hmm. right? And then these more remote areas are less populated and in some ways more white, to put, you know, too fine a point right. on it. But what winds up happening is you get, talk about like the Katrina issue, you know, you have Kanye West on television say George Bush doesn't care about black people. And he's talking about the city of New Orleans because New Orleans is, you know, predominantly black in the area that was most affected when the levees broke. But you have these well-to-do houses in like the areas just north of the levees that are fine and left all untouched. So the idea of like upheaval and uprising really does kind of talk to itself, because it's like, well, when do we open the economy? When do we open the schools? When do we open the businesses? And who ultimately benefits when you do this idea of like, well, let's start at the top as it kind of trickles down. The story about, I guess, movement, everything that rises, right. really does play with all of those variables in the socioeconomic, palette, which is fascinating and cool and sad and wonderful. Right.
Real quick, just on the COVID point. So one thing that's kind of that, and this is something I love about literature, and I'm sure you do too, about, or really any kind of art, is just how much it can shift and change based on when you're reading it and what context you're bringing to bear on the story you're reading. So one thing that had never occurred to me prior to, or in prior readings, but that is really relevant, really apparent to me now, is just the sense of contagion of getting on this bus. Yeah. So it's, for her, yeah. it's kind of, it's a racial thing, but it's interesting too that in this time, you feel a little bit more of that anxiety of getting into a public public place, and I find that, I don't know, kind of strangely interesting.
When we were kids, you mentioned you grew up in a bunch of different places, but you remember airports or airplanes that had like a smoking yeah. section? Like, isn't that yeah. crazy, right? Like, talking about a contagion. Like, to put yourself in the back of the airplane so you didn't have to smell cigarettes.
Right.
It's like, no, that's not how this works. But again, in the 1950s and 60s, as buses are starting to be integrated, feeling like there's an infection, a plague yeah. of this uprising of this other, this color mm-hmm, thing. Mm-hmm. And, oh yeah, that's not to be around us. When they do get on the bus, they do talk about, like, it looks like we're alone.
Right.
Us. And it's low-key, like, us white folk, because, like, the black folk are somehow almost like a swamp monster from the bayou kind of rising up.
Yeah, that's right. You're right. There's that sense. Yeah.
So speaking of infected and uprising, we do see early in the story that this mom is wearing a hat, says it's purple velvet flap. It's an ugly, Julian calls it hideous, less comical than jaunty and pathetic. It's small and it depresses him. But in her hat, she has two wings of gray hair on either side, and her eyes are sky blue, which makes her appear innocent, as almost if she's 10. That, I think that's an authorial nod. Flannery O'Connor has a soft spot for birds. She raised peafowl and pigeons and peacocks. And for her, anything that's likened to a bird does have a sense of like freedom and beauty and innocence. And I think that in this moment, she's giving a hint that yes, this woman is low-key racist, but that doesn't mean that she doesn't have something that she could show you or teach you or lead you to that is like, don't throw the baby out with the bathwater, right? Like, there's not black and white characters here. And I love...
No pun intended.
Like confluence. Right. I didn't realize that. Puns. Yay. Let's go. So they're getting ready, and mom's taking forever putting on this hat.
$7.50 hat.
$7.50 hat. Did you make anything of that, or was it just a reminder?
I love that about Flannery O'Connor. I mean, it's like 165 to 200. Like her specificity in numbers makes you. I went as far as to like. I figured out the inflation rate. Yeah,
inflation,
so it's like about $26 hat, which is great because it's like just expensive enough to be like, kind of a little purchase, but also like not that big of a deal. So she's obsessing over this, like kind of not really that expensive, like maybe marginally expensive, but $26 for a hat now is not that bad.
If your wife came home from Target, like with a 1999 straw hat, you'd be like, all right, that's fine. Did you get granola bars, and did you get like, wipes, or did you get a DVD? Because when you go to Target, it's hard to walk out for less than $40.
Right.
Fine. Whoa, $27 on a hat. We have a conversation.
And she's obsessing over it because he's like, it's not a great hat, according to Julian, but she's like, and all of her little expressions. You're right. She's super innocent. I think it's, she says over and over and over again, what's that phrase she uses? At least I, you know, I at least won't meet myself coming and going. She's always using these little expressions. She is very innocent. Yep. You know, she, you're right. She's low-key racist. Or not even low-key. But you know, there is a sense that it's really not, it's not conscientious really. It's
folksy and well-meaning, yeah. I think, but that doesn't take away from the fact that it might be really racist. Yeah. But she says, you know, I won't meet myself coming and going, which basically says I will at least stand out. No one will look like I look. Plot twist. We'll get there. So she talks about her neighborhood and that she wanted to live in this neighborhood. They describe it in like almost like apocryphal terms. The sky was a dying violet. The houses stood darkly against it. Bulbous, livered colored monstrosities in a uniform ugliness, though no two were alike. That seems to be like a judgment, like this festering swamp of where they live. This family grows up there. And now it's like there's every house has dirt. There's grubby children in the area. It's like don't look now, but that which was the gentry, the aristocracy, is now become like the working class, maybe even the white trash. And it seems like that's not lost on Julian, who has to sit here and sort of stew in that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
Do you have empathy? You should always have. So the answer should be yes. Full stop. Period. The end. But like, do you have sympathy for Julian as a character here? Like. Or do you think that Flannery O'Connor wants us to have sympathy or empathy for Julian, this sort of college-educated son who comes back in town, has to live with this folksy provincial mom who, like, bless her heart, she's an idiot. And she's
right,
an
right.
And. I don't know.
Thought. Something that's troubled me about Flannery O'Connor is that you sometimes aren't quite sure if maybe you're sympathizing with a character she would want you to sympathize with, and vice versa. It's very difficult to tell with her, because she makes it pretty good. She makes it abundantly clear over the course of her her literature that she does not find young, well-educated people to be very like just good. You know, so like she's publishing this at a time where, you know, frankly, it was, you know. You've got Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, and you've got In the Heat of the Night, and you know it is definitely cooler, quote unquote. You know, like you're supposed to be sympathizing more with the the younger liberal characters, and she's not. But on the other hand, she's not telling you to throw your hat in with the other characters either. So she always manages to kind of stand back from everything. And she's, I think, very ahead of her time and much more appropriate now, because this is a great time for white liberals to be, you know, turning an eye on themselves. And
oh, and I think that's so cool. You're so right. Oh my gosh. About like this woke culture, about like white kids who like have their token black friend and their pictures of them doing social justice, but it's like, oh my God, it's so patronizing.
And exactly. So I think you are supposed to sympathize with him, but just like in the same way that you're supposed to kind of detest his mother, but at the same time, feel sympathy with her. And I think it's the same thing. Like she's got this kind of mirror image with the two of them where you're supposed to some degree admire maybe like his apparent recognition of their, like she's obsessed with this plantation, this idealized plantations, you know, that they used to be a part of. But he's also, you know, he's not confronting the reality of his physical life either. He's living in his own ideal headspace that he can't get out of. He's got a kind of mirror opposite problem. And he's using the black people that he comes into contact with. He's literally using as pawns in his own game. He's not seeing he's not seeing their real selves at all. He's using them as pawns.
I agree. So there's a manipulation and moving people around, and both of these parent and this child are doing that thing where like the people who are not like us are there as a supporting character to our story, and our story is the story, and everyone else is just sort of like, play your part, come in, do your bow, and walk away.
Yeah.
You know, like it's not. And they talk about, he says, when he feels saturated in depression, as if in the midst of his martyrdom, he had lost his faith. So in this moment, he's going to have a chance. I'm like, by the end of the story, he will have a chance to come back to that which is important. And I do think about, did you have a chance to ever read, and it's okay if the answer is no, in fact it's a better podcast if it's no, did you have a chance to read Go Set a Watch?
I never did. I didn't want to. I don't know. I was really
don't
yeah
do it.
I kind of didn't
it.
Want to
it is like the same week that Hulk Hogan uses the N-word, it's like, oh my God, all of my childhood heroes were horribly racist.
Right, right.
That book is not, like, it will take the shine off of your Atticus Finch of your childhood. And what winds up happening is it's the retelling of it as an adult version of the scout character, who is a loosely fictionalized Harper Lee, comes back smoking cigarettes from college and, like, with her hair done up in a bun and, like, to the family's, like, decaying plantation home, and finds out her dad was maybe in the Klan and, like, things were not good. And it's just the nostalgia of it is what makes the innocence of the childhood so pure. But, like, when you look back with these, like, woke college eyes, immediately you jump to judgment of everything. Mm-hmm. And neither of them are right, because both of them deny the goods and bads and the vagaries that sort of exist, yeah, because people are
right. One of the things I think that Flannery O'Connor's Catholicism really was a great strength for her writing is that readiness and willingness and even eagerness to force her characters to deal with the flesh and blood reality of their lives rather than some kind of idealized way that they wish that they were living.
Yeah. She says that the true greatness of her, or the true strength of a Southern author, is their ability to recognize still have the ability to recognize a freak or the grotesque. Whereas the North has sort of normalized.
Right.
She's like, no, that's weird. And I'm going to call it out. She does say, and she says that it's a wonder we can enjoy anything. I'll tell you, the bottom rail is on the top. And that is not unnoticed when you're talking about race, right? Like, white is starting to come down, black is starting to come up. And that idea of defending the old way, even the fact that she dwells on the price of that hat, seems to suggest that the good old days, as Billy Joel might sing, weren't always.
Yeah.
And there's something about that that's coming.
Well, and that's another one of those little, like, I always got the sense over the course, every time I read this, I always got the sense that she doesn't necessarily believe everything she's saying. She is, she definitely is, like, drank this water and has lived, your great grandfather was a former governor of the state. Your grandfather was a prosperous landowner, et cetera, et cetera. You hear her just repeating phrases and things that I'm not entirely sure she's like, I tell you, with the world and mess it's in, but you get the sense that she's not really sure that, I don't know if she really thinks the world's in a mess. I mean, she kind of knows that it's, but she's just spinning out these little lines like, oh, the bottom rail's on the top and do, 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 do. And
we're
made ourselves coming and going. And it's just like an expression. She just
it's like a stump speech, right? A platitude that is the thing you don't have to think about. You just spit it out automatically. And then when you simplify, you falsify. So like what you've done is you've stopped to pay attention. You stopped paying attention. Maybe it came from a place that it was like the thing to say. But he says at one point when they have this argument, he goes, oh, here we go again. Right. She'd grown off on that same topic. She rolled on every few days like a train on a track. And I love this line. I've used it even in arguments with friends and family. Like, he knew every stop, every junction, every swamp along the way. He knew that point of the conclusion. Like
everything that rises must converge.
Oh my God. Right. And I don't know that your family is like my family. I don't want to put dirt on anybody's head, to use the language of Huckleberry Finn and Jim. But like, you've been at family or friend events there, it gives us some plausible deniability, where like, if people just get to drinking, conversations eventually turn to politics, and politics eventually turn into, the problem with the world.
Right.
And you're like, now it's time to get my coat. And
right. Well, and even just on a personal level, like everybody's has somebody that they know really well where they fight with them. And you get to a point where you're like, okay, I know every stop in the store. And it starts to anger both people. You usually, right. You're like, I see every moment in this and I see where this is going. And
I will be honest. I did not think that the COVID stuff would end up being politicized as fast as it has. But the idea that there are large groups of people who, and again, Flannery O'Connor, we talked about it, is a very Catholic person. She's very Vatican I Catholic. The idea of like fighting for social justice and like life issues is a very Catholic thing. But those persons who self-identify as like pro-life persons, that it's very strange in my Catholic understanding of the world that these would be the same people who would be arguing to open businesses when you have like a 4% mortality rate and 15% hospitalization rate.
There's a willingness to pay. Okay, this many people, I'm okay with this many old people or disabled people or otherwise vulnerable people to die. Exactly. I recognize, obviously everyone recognizes the cost of having everything shut down. But you're right. Like, I'm shocked that people are like, the argument isn't we have to figure out how to best to end this so that we can get back to work. But these are acceptable lives to pay.
Correct. So now I'm going to existential stuff, and I'm thinking about, like, you know, Waiting for Godot, where Didi and Gogo are talking, and they talk about there's a finite amount of tears in the world, so it is with laughter. Like, if somebody is feeling good, someone else must be feeling bad. It's like, what if that's not the way it is? What if this scale we've created is a man-made scale? And you're like, no. If black people are getting better, that doesn't mean that white people are getting worse. Yeah. Like, if sick people are finding themselves vulnerable, that doesn't mean that poor people are in some ways, like, obligated to make themselves sick so that others, it's like, no. There's that's a scarcity mindset. Yeah. And I think that O'Connor's talking about that here with the idea of, like, this falling, this decay. She talks about, like, the grandmother was a god high. That's mm-hmm. a very non-Catholic name, but it's clearly one that was picked so that we could see there was a time and a place .. And then she says, you know, you remain what you are. Your great-grandfather had a plantation and 200 slaves. Right. And when then they have the fight about slaves, well, they were better off where they were. You know, it's ridiculous. It's not realistic. They should rise.
On their own side. and again, so, the title, right? On their own side of the fence. This line, you know, because I don't want to jump too far. It's hard in the story to not jump ahead always, but when talking about it. But one thing that's, I think, so brilliant about this, again, for both Julian and his mother, is that they're both using all African Americans as pawns in their own little game of themselves. You know, it's for him, it's his idealized sense of self martyrdom and his wokeness. But he just wants to use any black person that he meets on the bus in his pawn to upset his mother and to be right. Yeah. He just wants to be right. And you can't control. But the thing is, and this is so, again, so great about her, is that you can't control other people. Like, other people are other people. And so he's so, you know, his mother sees this little baby, this kid, this little child on the bus, you know, the mother. Carver, and like, his mother is not being nice to him, you know, and it's like, it bothers Julian so much that the when he's trying to interact with black people on the bus, they're not nice to him. Like, they don't want to hang out. And he's kind of, he never really expresses it, because that would be unwoke of him. But he's irritated.
Right. He would lose his like, if it's story is set today. So we are getting a little ahead of ourselves, but that's good. So, like, to reset the table, they're about to get on the bus, and in his head, he's racing through all the ways he can embarrass mom with her horribly racist comments, and the things he's thinking about are like, I'll sit by black folks and I'll try to talk to him. But he also spins around the fact that, well, I try to talk to him, but darn it, they don't ever talk
right.
to him. He seems to be like, and again, you're in education, like, I studied literature. The teacher who puts the hat on backwards, turns the chair around and says, yo, my dogs, let's rap about Tupac. Right. And your kids are like, I hate you.
Yeah,
like,
he's
culturally appropriating and trying way too hard. There's nothing authentic.
It's the Steve Buscemi, you know, gif. What's up, my fellow kids?
Oh my God. Yes. It's that, right? So, but it's worse because it's about race.
Right.
So they're talking about living in different circumstances, and they say that the family is, you know, actually this place belonged to the God Highs, but your grandfather, Chesney, paid the mortgage and saved it for them. She mentions about their family. This is a time ago, which is like, again, the Billy Joel line, the good old days weren't always good. This house belonged to your family. They were in reducing
classes. Yeah.
Like, there's a connection there. Like, no, there was always a decay. Like, there's something inevitable about, like, death and taxes, right? Like, things were always falling apart. Things were always not quite as wonderful. Oh, yeah, and by the way, that was only propped up by the fact that you had 200 working people that you were not paying who happened to be persons of a different color. And that's what the foundation of this house, of this family, was based on. But I'm interested, because you mentioned the idea of Julian kind of romanticizes or fantasizes about this lost plantation. Do you want to talk about, like, how that kind of plays out here in the story, and maybe what that recalls for you?
I think that's one of the I love that part, because that's where I think O'Connor really does kind of bring home the mirror image that I was saying, you know, that Julian's mother's living in this her own made up, you know, idealized reality. But then you find that he's not really unable to let go of that either. He's kind of conscious, you know, he's kind of created also this this image in his head as well. So I think that, you know, I mentioned at the very beginning that I felt like this was a great exploration of geographic responses to racism and also for the 21st century. And I think this is part of it. There's an internalized sense of white supremacy that I think even the most woke white person is loath to let go of. Like, there is a sense, you know, like he feels superior to everybody. He feels superior to his mother. He feels superior. He genuinely, like, he is in this inside of his head. He is still, he's a benevolent plantation owner in his head. You know, he's allowed to laze around his plantation with noblesse oblige. But he likes that sense of superiority. He feels superiority over absolutely everyone, including his mother. Yeah. And it's that moment where he goes into his head and remembers that you realize the degree to which he's also, you know, he, like her, is kind of living in this headspace. And, you know, it's the mental bubble, right? That's a little bit, you know, around there, right? That after she says Rome wasn't built in a day, again, another little platitude, you know, he has not turned this fine sense of societal and motherly maternal critique. He's not turned it on to himself. He's genuinely in a mental bubble where he is safe from any kind of penetration. I even apparently a long time ago marked this in my copy of it. I have like a little pencil mark around from it. He could see out and judge. But in it, he was safe from any kind of penetration from without. And one of Flannery O'Connor is so great about writings like that, because she's able to say something that both communicates a sense of that person and then is also stands out as true apart from them. Right. So he is genuinely safe from any kind of penetration. And that's a problem. That's a really big problem.
And he ivory towers it sort of a little bit, like, you know, like he's safe from people coming in those walls. But it's interesting too, because he talked about he had only ever seen that house but once in his childhood after it had already been sold, but still he romanticized it. And later he talks about it that, like, that his mom and his mom's generation had, like, stolen that from him. And I'm interested because, you know, today there's these fights between these baby boomers and these millennials, even to the point where there are people in colleges who are arguing quite interestingly that the word boomer is like using the N-word, and I have a lot of thoughts about that, right? Like, but then the fight online is between, like, generation one and generation two, which is, hey, I like hardwood floors and your generation covered them over with cheap linoleum and carpet, thanks boomers, right? Like, I think there's that idea that every generation that is the subsequent one simultaneously looks back at, like, the great grandfathers with a level of reverence or respect or entitlement. Like, yeah, that's how it was. That's my mm-hmm. bloodline, my lineage. But then there's the one who's immediate ahead of you, who's like, oh, but you guys went and screwed this whole thing up. And I think that's how he looks at his mom. Mm-hmm. You know, the idea that was family land up until your generation did something stupid. And then now I got nothing. And he talks about how all the neighborhoods they had lived in had been a torment to him. Since that time when this was my thing and you've ruined it.
Right. The struggle to act like a Chesney without the Chesney goods.
I'm interested here too. And then they move to the next year. He says, you know, she says, I remember an old darkie who was my nurse. Oh, here we go. And the nurse's name is Caroline. That name will be important later. She says, there was no better person in the world. Quote, I've always had a great respect for my colored friends. I'd do anything in the world for them. And I'm interested here because that line that mom says, I think mom genuinely believes that. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't respect the black folk, but the ones of the black folk who are my friends, I respect them incredibly. I'm kind to them, which is to say I give them money while they, like, take care of me or provide me with a service or an entertainment. And for that reason, I'll throw a quarter their way every time. She genuinely believes that. In a 1950s author's writing, this woman is maybe born in, like, I don't know, let's say the 1890s or the 1900s, mm-hmm. right? Like, so that is the woke culture of her day, which is, I'm a little less racist than the people before me who owned these people. See, I'm paying for them. Aren't I? Like, if this idea of woke culture showed up back in the day, she would be offending her father by simply being nice to the house hired help. Like, that's something that would be unbecoming of, you know, a God high, right? And then her son is like, no, that's not enough, Ma. You have to, like, want to talk to him and sit with them. But plot twist, they're people. They don't want to talk to you because they see what you're doing. You're trying to, like, score, like, guilt points. And he talks about when he gets on the bus, he makes a point of sitting by a Negro, quote, in reparation, as it were.
As it were. That's a great moment, too, because, I'd have to do some digging into this, but I cannot imagine that there haven't been discussions of slavery. I mean, there were. In fact, I guess I can say this with certainty, that there have always been discussions of slavery reparations. Yes. And as well-meaning as white people were, they were always like, I don't know if we need to pay back everything that we stole, you know, like I know that we didn't actually pay them for any of the labor for, you know, like several centuries, but you know, that's just a little too much. So let's give them reparations as it were. I will sit next to you.
But I love it that, like, no, you know, I can't pay you. And the truth is there is no money because they dig in their pockets later. Spoilers. You can't find a nickel.
Right, find a penny. Right.
And they have to whine about spending $30 on a hat. But, you know, I just love that those three words, because they undermine the entire strength of the argument. In reparation, as it were, for. Like, okay, so I don't have this. It's like the little drummer boy. I have no gift to bring, but I'll play you my drum. We're good? Like, sorry I enslaved you people.
But I'll sit next to you and I'll make my mother uncomfortable.
Which is, you know, in some ways, that's like, it's even. But before we get onto the bus, because we're about to get on the bus shortly, as the bus appears, there's an interesting moment of class distinction here. And this is probably our last chance to talk about it before we get onto the bus, because once we get in the bus, we meet some characters and we'll spend next week on that podcast. But as he's settling in to do this long ride, Mom has gone through extreme lengths to make sure that she looked like a lady. They mentioned that she's one of the only people in the Y who still shows up dressed like that. And I think about that. We talked about flying airplanes earlier. Like when I was a kid, you got dressed up to go on an airplane. It was like a thing you did. I don't know why, but people just wore shirts and ties and suits. And like when we went to Broadway shows, which is a very like culture classed thing to do, like because you're spending $100 on a ticket, you dressed up to go to the city. Now it's no sight to see people walking around with like jeans and t-shirts, and who cares? Like they're walking through the city, so they're just going to see a show. But as they're about to get on the bus, and Mom has been like super aware of putting on her ostentatious hat and like her gloves, Julian goes the exact opposite
way. Loosens his tie.
So, yeah. And she's like, why do you have to look like that when you take me to town? Why must you deliberately embarrass me? And he's like, he's thinking to her, look at how you are looking. That is an embarrassment to me. She says, quote, you look like a thug, she says. And I'm interested to hear about this too, because I don't think, and I would have to do some research, but like in the 1950s when this story is written, I don't think the word thug carries the same social connotation, black, white, as it does today. I believe as a child of immigrants myself, my mom's entire family is Italian. My dad's Irish, Polish. Like there are plenty of thugs like, hey, forget about it. Like they're the guys who show up at your house with like a baseball bat. It would be a shame if someone was to take that nice, you know, like that's what we are. When I say thug, it's like a lower class white folk. I think that's what she's saying, which is like you are not representing this aristocracy of who we are, like our lineage or stock. I don't think it's said they're like you're like a hoodie thug Trayvon Martin who's trying to like, you know, sneak through the streets.
I think
that's
right. I think you're right. The thug, it's a reference to like an Indian assassin, I believe. Thuggies,
really?
They were
Like
a group of assassins, I believe, literally in India that they had these.
I know that from Indiana Jones, from the second Indiana Jones movie.
Because they would put like a rope with a knot in it that would go right over the throat. And so it would be interesting it's from Hindi, thug.
Yeah, it's from the second Indiana Jones movie that I'm like, talk about cultural appropriation. The only reason why white folks know about thugs is because a guy who is like raiding tombs of other cultures to be a white savior and like save the native people.
Right. Oh, so I'm looking. Okay. So we're doing some live. No, I knew this ahead of time. We'll pretend. No, but I just looked up in the OED. Sure. I just looked up in the OED and definitely from, you know, from basically it seems from the late 19th century into the 20th century, it had definitely been like related to these Indian assassins, as it were, but then had started been in reference to like the brown shirts and things, and you know, and so exactly, it's not I don't think it's as racial as much as like brutishly othered.
See, I think
which I guess is kind of racial, but you know what I mean.
Well, now that I think about it, too, like Italians or like all the signs, Irish need not apply. Like everybody on the social ladder is always punching down to the one behind them because the next generation is just a little darker, a little bit more foreign, right? Like, but I think my own Italian ancestry, like the idea of the othered assassin, mm-hmm. Italians, of course, are loud, hairy, they speak funny, they wave their hands around, they're projected as like, in some ways, more base, more animal than like this urbane, sophisticated WASP culture, which is again what O'Connor's writing about here. And I think about it too. Even to today, when you watch sitcoms, and they don't exist as much anymore, but like sitcoms with laugh tracks, you see two white people kiss on a laugh track sitcom, and it's like, oh, and you hear the clap, 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 clap from these people who have been recorded from the 1920s, long dead. But you see an ethnic kiss, like a white person kisses a black person, or two black persons kiss, or two Latinx persons kisses. And then it's the, woo! Like there's this fetishization of the exotic and the idea of like a thug is like a hired assassin, like an othered monstrous type thing. It's not becoming of the rank and file that is our people. And I think that othering here is maybe what she's pointing
at.
It was interesting because they're about to get on the bus. And as they're about to get on the bus, this is a good place to stop the podcast this week. He's like, look, I will fix this on your account. He straightens his tie, but like begrudgingly. Yeah. And as they're about to get on the bus, he says, you know, mom, you got this whole thing messed up. Restore to my class. True culture's in the mind.
The mind.
He says it three times, right? You know, like how you do things. As a maybe like a mini cliffhanger for next week, why should someone tune in for the second half of this week?
Okay. I'm so glad you said that. Because you know this is truly a great place to stop because the I think this is the I guess the fulcrum of the whole story. This is the this is frankly the moment that this is I think the way to sum up everything, which is true. He's saying true culture is in the mind. He's completely wrong, and here she's ironically completely right. You know, she said it's in the heart and how you do things, and how you do things is because of who you are. Now I wish she knew that, like I wish she had literally lived that out, but she's kind of right, you know.
So now it's a chicken and an egg situation, and one of them's going to find out that their goose is cooked. Look at that, that's a pun. So we'll stop it there. I'm on Twitter at @mehan_edu if you want to hang out with me. I would love to talk literature, talk books. If you want to be on the podcast, message me, let me know. Chris, you've mentioned that you're not on Twitter, but maybe on Twitter, but you have a website.
I do, chrismacholsky.weebly.com. So my name's kind of long, but
I'll put it in the show notes so if people want to hang out, they can hang out. And if by the time this goes live we wind up having a Twitter feed for you, are you cool talking about literature, English, and all sorts of stuff?
Absolutely,
on the internet?
Absolutely.
Cool. I'll have people hang out with you and talk about that. Thanks again for tuning in, guys. If you like, again, subscribe, leave a comment. It helps people find the podcast. We'll be back next week with more. Stay safe, stay healthy, and we'll see you next time. Thanks again.